Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. For Jodi Katz, it's all about beauty, the beauty industry. And to that end, her four-year stint as the first U.S. creative director of L'Occitane en Provence led her to form her own company in 2007, Base Beauty Creative Agency. Based in New York, its focus is strategic marketing, content creation, packaging design, and advertising, and includes successful campaigns for Clinique, Conair, Weight Watchers, L'Oréal Paris, along with smaller companies. According to Jodi, no beauty brand operates in a vacuum, and to that end, her company's focus is threefold. Image, which includes strategy, creative development, image campaigns, social media content, advertising, packaging, design and development, and public relations. In Jodi's words, rewrite the rules. Speaking of words, Jodi is also host of her own podcast, Where Brains Meet Beauty. So Jodi, welcome and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's so cool to be here. And you have such an incredible voice. I love listening to you.
Well, that's because I don't have an incredible face. But thank you. That's very nice. So why, how, when did you get into the beauty business?
It's totally an accident, like most things. Mm. I was always in, I'd say, like image-driven businesses. I had a job at BBDO, which is a huge Omnicom agency right out of college. Mm-hmm. And I was what I call an account girl because there it's a, you know, very large, hierarchical company.
I used to work at Ogilvy and May there, so I certainly know BBDO.
Mm-hmm. And back in that time, my job was basically to run dupes, like just make duplicate copies of tapes, right? That was like the junior
job.
That's
exciting.
Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't happen in the industry right now. We don't have tapes, right?
Exactly.
So my job was to make dupes, to run the dupes around.
Tapes of what?
Commercials. And I really thought of my job as I would move like a piece of paper from one side of a pile or a desk to another.
You get paid well for that?
No, I think it was like $24,000 a year, but...
Back in the day, not bad, huh?
It was a starting salary. I was living in New York City, definitely racking up the credit card debt, but...
Did you major in business in college?
Government and law.
All right, okay.
I really did go to school thinking, like, I want to be somewhere in government. I wanted to advocate. I wanted to, you know, make things better for people.
Did you think you wanted to be a lawyer?
Yeah, I thought that would be a pathway to that.
Sure.
I got really disenchanted with the experience of like moving through the process and playing the game. To do good for A means I might have to do bad for B, right? And like making these choices, it seemed really kind of too much. It was really just too much to bear. And then I just sort of decided, nah, I'm not going to go this route. And luckily enough, at the time, I had a boyfriend whose uncle was running BBDO and I got an internship.
Not bad.
Mm-hmm. I married the boyfriend.
Oh, did you?
Yep. Many years later.
Uh-huh.
So I ended up in advertising, which seemed like a good fit. Like pop culture is always inspiring to me. I love commercials. Like this is, you know, sort of why I watched TV as a kid. So to be part of that process is really cool. But I was kind of like a know-it-all, jerky, you know, person right out of college. Thought I knew more than people who've been doing this for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I really got itchy with the hierarchy. I really struggled with it.
Well, were you bored moving papers from one pile to another? That's really drudge work. Not very creative or exciting or sexy.
I don't know that I was bored exactly because there was so much to do. I was on a very big piece of business, a really high-profile piece of business for the agency. People were really nice and, like, really wanted to, you know, give me more work. And my boss and my boss's boss were incredible people. I felt really taken care of, you know, nurtured
mentored
for growth. Yeah, to my boss's boss. Yes, absolutely. Adina Kagan to this day. I, you know, looked to her.
Oh, a woman.
Yes, mm-hmm. As one of like the best. She wasn't my direct boss, but she's one of the best bosses I ever had. She really took the time to try to figure out like what is going to give Jodi the direction that she needs. You know, she was really trying to work for me.
Even though you weren't sure what that direction was necessarily.
Yeah, I think we all understood that, like, maybe this is, like, you know, a little bit combustible for me, right? I was, like, I was a jerk, you know? I was smart, but just not that nice about it and a little bit...
So arrogant? Is
that
what you're saying?
I think so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, there's something to be said for not being full of yourself necessarily, but having a strong sense of self, right?
Yeah.
Or am I being nice about
that? I think
that?
I was just being rebellious against the hierarchy. And, like, in college, I was so coddled. I went to Lafayette College in Eastern Pennsylvania, a really small liberal arts school, and anything you wanted to do there, you could do. People will support you. I wanted to do this. I wanted to do that. I wanted to be president of student government. Sure. I wanted to invent a whatever. Sure.
As long as your parents paid your tuition.
That's right. But like it was this sort of like I was heard, right? At mm-hmm. school, I was so heard, right? In every single aspect, whether it was academics or outside of the classroom. So to land in New York City and be like so unheard, mm-hmm, right? It was mm-hmm. really
just a cog in a wheel.
Yeah, it was mm-hmm. really a struggle for me. I had great relationships with clients. I had great relationships with my team. And like, they were, you know, it's at a big agency like that. It's very social for all the young people. So I had a lot of fun. But I had a really hard time being able to, like, not be in the room and say what I needed to say, mm-hmm. right? The hierarchy really prevented that. And when I did do it, obviously, like, I was talked to often. But I liked seeing that part of the world, mm-hmm. you know? I liked seeing how the sausage was made, you know? And, like, what better perspective to do it than at BBDO, where they were creating campaigns for Pepsi. I was on the Visa credit card account, GE. Like, some of, like, the most famous advertising campaigns came out of that.
So you learned a lot.
What it did is prepared me to run my own business later, years later.
Well, you stayed at BBDO for how long?
1 year.
And then?
I don't think I was very enlightened at the time. I was really just very like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Let me get a new job. So I interviewed for a job at Cosmopolitan Magazine as the assistant to the editor-in-chief.
Was that Helen Gurley Brown days or afterwards?
No, it was after Helen. It was Bonnie Fuller. And I really didn't know what I was walking into. I just wanted to leave, like, the suit and tie environment of BBDO. And Cosmo at the time was very, like, flip-flops and tank tops. Like, it was just very casual.
What year are we talking about?
1998.
And how old are you now?
I'm 42. So I got this job. I was the number two assistant. There were two of us. The number one assistant, Michelle Rubel, was so good at her job. Like, she knew how to order the lunch. She knew how to make the dinner reservation. She knew what flowers to order. She knew who to call for whatever. Like this, she was just on top of it and got it.
And that's what you aspired to do?
That was my job. This is the job.
Is this a little Devil Wears Prada-ish?
Yes. I would say it's Devil Wears Prada, but not with the esteem of the Vogue environment. You know, it's still a very high-profile publication, but it just really felt much more mom and pop.
Oh, so it was not as nasty.
I would say that, like, most of the people who worked there were incredibly nice, down-to-earth, smart, kind people. There were a few prima donnas. Mm-hmm. And then Bonnie was, I would say, like, disinterested in, you know, anything that I had to do, right?
It
was
just sort of do it.
I mean, I didn't have any instruction on what to do. Michelle, thank goodness she was there, because I really would have been very lost and out the door in a week.
So you went in, on some level, for moving papers from one pile to another to not so much different work in
I was heating up lunch.
Heating up lunch.
Yeah. This was exciting because it was really high profile. And, you know, here I am in another image-driven type of business, right? Mm-hmm. Going from advertising to publication and a high profile one at that. But no, this was not the dream job. But what it did is it showed me that I do not want to be Bonnie at some point. Like, you know, after a few months there, I realized everyone's super nice, but it's not right for me.
As in, it might be a thankless job?
No, that I didn't have, like, a longing to be Bonnie someday. You know, mm-hmm. It just wasn't part of, like, my gut check wasn't like, oh, my God, I want to work really hard and I want to get out of this assistant job and then get into be, like, you know, assistant editor or this or that. I didn't want to be a fashion editor. I didn't want to be a beauty editor. I didn't want to write about whatever. Like, it just none of it really interested me a lot. Mm-hmm. I had an incredible vantage point to see the magazine get made from the top. And I didn't yearn for it. But what was interesting is Bonnie left from Cosmo and then went to Glamour. So she went from Hearst to Condé Nast, and I went with her.
She took you?
Yes, mm-hmm. Michelle and I. I don't know if she really took me or just sort of along for the ride, right?
I'm here.
Yeah, I mean, my job was to be invisible.
Must have been a really tough for somebody who admits and says that being invisible goes against your grain.
You know, I think that every day was just so challenging for me, quite honestly, like in terms of like, I don't understand what to do. You know, I just really didn't get it. At BBDO, I knew what my job was. At the magazine, I really didn't understand it. Like, I was just not clued into what she needed. I wasn't able to anticipate. I think I was like a robot that was never programmed. If Michelle wasn't there to give me like a little bit of guidance, and it wasn't her job to manage me, she was just, you know, one of two people. And there was, like, the niceness of other people in the business who, I guess, knew how to anticipate Bonnie's needs that helped me a little bit. But it was just, like, I was just clueless. But the vantage point of being able to go from Hearst to Condé Nast was very fascinating. And I knew that was very fascinating. Like, this was, like, kind of, like, the little gift of the job for me, which was seeing Hearst at the time it operated very mom and pop. Cosmo was its own business. We had our own supply closet, right? We had our own things. We worked very independent from what I could see from any of the other publications. But then at Condé Nast, no, this was like a corporation and everything's very integrated. And no, we did not have our own Post-it notes. There was like, you know, a depository for Post-it notes somewhere else in the building. And just being able to see the ways that the two different corporations operated, it was like night and day. I was very fascinated by that.
So you're absorbing all of this.
Yeah. And I don't know what I'm doing with it, but mm-hmm. I just noticed it and I thought it was very cool. Mm-hmm. This was not the job for me. And I was talking to my mother about it one day, like, this doesn't feel right. Like, it's not really that interesting. At the time, I was very interested in food. And in college, I had written my independent study about food criticism. Like, this was something that I was really obsessed with at the time. She's like, so just go to HR and ask if you can get moved to a food magazine. Okay, so...
That's not unreasonable.
It is unreasonable considering what happened, which was by the time I left the office of the HR person to come back up in the elevator to go to my desk at Bonnie's office, I was fired.
I was just going to say that.
Right. You know, I do have one friend in HR and I love him and adore him, but I don't think this is the actual right path for anybody to take. It's never been, in my experience, the place you go for honest conversations. And it's unfortunate because...
Well, they have an agenda.
Yes, but like I think as a young employee, you just don't understand it. Mm-hmm. Like, you think they're there for you. And my advice to people would be, you know, find another way.
So you're unemployed.
Yeah. I mean, I was unemployed so often. Like, I was fired, laid off.
So when did food morph into beauty?
You know, I think at some point I just lost an appetite for playing the game of what was happening at the time, which was dot-coms were starting to grow. So we can have access to information very quickly and access to kind of like cheap information, you know, not well thought out information. So where restaurant criticism was when I was studying it, where it was like New York Times, New York Magazine, like studying like, you know, really great writers. By the time the dot-com started popping up and they were writing about food and restaurants, is really just about like, this place opened, right? It was just information. It wasn't a review. It wasn't well thought out. Or if reviews were happening, they were happening like the night that the restaurant opened, which is something that the New York Times would never have done, right? Mm-hmm. New York Magazine would never have done. And it just became this sort of like churn of information.
No meat on the bone.
Beautiful pun.
You can use it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I really lost an appetite for it. I wasn't interested in that anymore. And I just sort of kept moving along, like really, like no plan. I just need a job. I worked in a flower shop during Valentine's Day. The flower shop was selling dead roses. Like really, I was customer service on the phone, you know, talking to people who were really upset. I just took jobs just to figure out how to get to the next place. I did land in the dot-com boom of 1999. It was a nightlife website. We wrote about parties. So I would like go out at night to bars and clubs and write about it the next day.
Well, that sounds kind of sexy.
It was great for my age. Mm-hmm. The company never made any money, but I did that in New York and I moved to Miami to do that. And that was super awesome.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And then went to LA to do it, which was not super awesome. And then eventually, I think I sort of like quit, got fired, or like maybe they stopped paying us, you know, that kind of thing. When I look back at my career, I mean, I've been a business owner for 10 years, but before that, I really just had a lot of jobs.
I can't imagine the length of your resume. It must be encyclopedic.
I don't use one anymore.
Well, duh, you don't need to, but I'm just saying.
It wasn't clear to me what I was searching for, but I knew I was searching for something. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I got a job at an advertising agency as a copywriter. Like, so I saw the copywriters and art directors of BBDO doing what they did. And they went to the movies a lot, but they also just sat around and talked, right, and thought. And I thought, well, I'd really like to do that someday, but I couldn't do that at BBDO. It's not the culture where you go from being account girl to, you know, getting that job. And I was not interested in going back to school. I was not going to make the investment in time or money to do that. Somehow, after this dot-com gig of writing about nightlife, an agency saw my work and thought I had the voice of youth. So I got a job as a legit copywriter.
Here, back in New York?
Yep. And that was when, the first time when I'm like, oh my God, this feels right. So I wasn't moving paper around, right?
And I wasn't, you weren't ordering lunch.
And I wasn't feeling clueless. And I was just paid to think. Mm. And this was like a huge light bulb moment for me. This is what I was searching for. The feeling that I had in college when I was able to do whatever I wanted to do, right? And I was supported. It gave me that kind of energy. And I'm like, this is it. I found it. This is my job. This is like where I want to be. And of course that, I think I got laid off from that job. Yeah.
But when did beauty come into the
equation?
Oh, this
is a great question. When I was a legit copywriter at an agency, I got a lot of work on the side, which is a beautiful thing for people in my industry as copywriters or art directors. You can always get freelance work.
While you still have a full-time job.
Yeah. And I got a job writing for Avon mm-hmm. for one of their catalogs. So it was like a lot of work, right? Every month, you know, they might have put out more than one book a month. So somehow I was able to, you know, weasel my way into that gig without any beauty experience. And that was a lot of work to show.
Did you feel like you were a fraud?
No. It mm-hmm. felt like a really good fit. It felt like this makes a lot of sense to me.
And even though beauty might not have been part of your DNA.
No, I think it is. I mean, I think what I've been able to do in any of my beauty work is actually like tell my vision of it.
But did you even know you had a vision?
I think so. Yeah, I grew up with, you know, a mom and a grandma and a great grandma who really appreciated beauty, going to the hair salon, buying new makeup. Like, this is part of the world that I was growing up in. I appreciated beauty. I was not a beauty junkie. 20 years ago, the business isn't what it was, what it is now, which is, you know, frenetic and filled with so many offerings. But I did connect with it. You know, it made sense to me. And it was very natural and very easy for me. So I got that Avon gig on the side. I got a gig from a skincare company. I got a gig from another one. And within a short amount of time, I had a portfolio of beauty. So after the agency laid me off, I found my way to L'Occitane.
And why don't you describe that company for people who don't know?
Well, you do know it. It's L'Occitane. And they have the best shea butter hand cream, the best product for dry hands. And in the U.S., there's like over 150 stores.
It's that a global, carry?
Yeah. It's a, well, their own stores.
Oh.
Brand-owned mm-hmm, stores. Mm-hmm. And it's a global company based in Paris and Provence. It was like the right place for me at the right time. And I stayed there for 4 years. And I really feel like it was like my education in beauty. It was
Did
like,
you go to Paris a lot?
Yeah. I went to Paris
Gee,
often.
That's too bad.
And to Provence often.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I had my freshman year there, my sophomore year, my junior year, my senior year. And I can really like look back and see like the different roles that I took. So I started as a copywriter. I was the first copywriter in the U.S. The team in France, they were terrified of me. They thought I was going to make the brand very like McDonald's.
Oh.
You know, really uh-huh. genuinely, they were terrified of what I was going to start doing mm-hmm. or like if I was going to have like free everything, you know, like sending email blasts with, you know, lots of promotional copy. They just were really terrified of what an American experience as a copywriter was going to add to the brand. And that was probably one of the best learnings working there, that I was able to, over time and slowly and patiently, build their trust to the point where, you know, I was doing work for them, where we were sharing work, where, you know, I was naming products, I was writing copy for products, it was global, right? So it wasn't an us versus them.
Who's your immediate boss?
There was a marketing director and then a general manager of
the
business in the
States.
Yeah.
So that probably was a seminal 4 years in terms of what you learned.
Yes. Number one, because I got an incredible training. Mm-hmm. So a big part of beauty, to be really good at beauty, is understanding the products and understanding how they work. And L'Occitane really invested in every single new hire, like really big training programs.
But did their makeup as well as body cream?
They had a little bit of color, but most of it is fragrance, skincare, body care, home fragrance. So I learned about the skin. I learned about products and ingredients. And I've always seen it through the eyes of the customer. Like, I never, ever feel like I am, like, part of a company or, you know, part of a brand. I'm always looking at things through the eyes of the customer. So I started as a copywriter there and eventually saw a need, like, wait a minute, we have other needs. And then I sort of learned to be an art director. And then I realized that I think I'm a better art director than I am a copywriter. And then over time, it's like, wow, we have needs. We're growing. Let's build a creative department. And someone let me build a creative department and hire people.
So you kind of had carte blanche there.
Yes, and run it. So by the time I left there, I was a creative director.
Why'd you leave?
I was getting a lot of work on the side once again. And it was a lot of work, like a lot of work.
So
and
it's freelance stuff.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was very fulfilling creatively and it was very fulfilling financially. And I just thought to myself, I don't need to be going to an office and doing the office stuff, like having to be in my seat by 9 a.m. or, you know, whatever the rules were. Hierarchy was always hard for me, as I mentioned. Not that there was an enormous amount of hierarchy at L'Occitane, but there still is a boss, right? Mm-hmm. And the boss has a boss. I was starting to feel really fulfilled creatively by the outside work, much more than the inside work, right? I've already written about lavender for 4 years. I've already photographed lavender for 4 years. I've already done videos about lavender for 4 years.
So who's reaching out to you while you're there?
Friends connected me with people who needed work. I mean, I think I worked on skincare. I worked on spa. I worked on probably some color at the time, you know, a little bit of everything. I had a lot of work on my plate, like literally like, up, you know, all hours doing my second job. So it was months of that, and I realizing, wait, this could be lucrative for me. I could be very comfortable. I was married at the time, so I didn't have to worry about health insurance. My husband had health insurance. Mm-hmm. Right? This is always a conversation for a freelancer. Where am
of
I going to get health insurance?
Sure.
So I just went for it.
And then that's what came out of it is the company that you formed?
Yeah, I mean, it was like really more
Base
like
beauty creative agency.
A year or so of just freelancing. The secondary reason why I left, it wasn't just a business reason, was I knew I wanted to be a mom. I wasn't pregnant at the time, but I knew I wanted to be a mom, and I wasn't seeing any modeling in the places that I worked for people who are parents and working at the same time. And I don't know why I didn't think like, oh, I can just go to another company and find that sort of flexibility that I'm looking for. I guess I just assumed that it didn't exist anywhere, and it really, quite frankly, probably didn't. So I just thought, like, if I want to do this and I want to be the mom the way that I want to be a mom and work, then I'm just going to have to go out on my own. So
a little naive, though, to think that you could start your own company and that that would give you, in a sense, more freedom.
Yes. But as a freelancer, like in my industry, there's so many freelancers and they really, you know, I'm not saying it's easy, right? Because you still have to hustle, but it's just so common to be a freelancer.
Yeah, but that's different than owning your own company.
Right. So first I was a freelancer. I didn't I didn't run a business. I was a freelancer. So that's, and I was already freelancing, right? During my full-time job. It wasn't until my son, after my son was born, when I realized that freelancing as a creative director just felt kind of odd and lonely. And
this is what year?
2007.
Uh-huh.
So I sort of had this light bulb moment that, like, if this is going to work, it needs to be a team. And I think I'm really good at pulling the team together and, like, giving a vision and allowing them to layer on the greatness. Yeah, I just sort of had this light bulb moment. But also from, like, a business perspective, as a freelancer, you get paid when you work. When you're not working, you're not getting paid. The agency model is just so genius. Even if I'm not working, my team is working, which means the business is running and operating and making money even without my actual hour.
Yes,
right?
But you're also paying people to work.
True, but it's a model that's, I think, incredibly beautiful versus manufacturing, where, like, you know, if I owned a beauty brand, I'd have to manufacture a bunch of stuff. I'd have to store it in a warehouse. I'd have to pay for the storage. I'd have to pay for the product and hope somebody wants to buy it.
Right. You just have to deal with human beings.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, they have to deal with human beings and product on shelf, mm-hmm. right, which is money on shelf. So I thought the model was beautiful. And I knew a woman in PR who had an agency, a PR agency, and they were strictly beauty. And she's incredibly successful. And I had a few conversations with her. I'm like, well, if she can do it for PR, I can do it for creative. And I knew that since I worked at L'Occitane, nobody was calling on me that was doing what I was doing, which was specializing in as beauty as an agency. I had agencies calling on us for, you know, maybe they were fashion agencies or maybe they were like hospitality, but I wasn't meeting any creative agency that was specializing in beauty. So here was a white space, right? So a friend of mine, you know, I knew she was doing it in PR. I can translate that to creative, all the other creative assets. I knew that there was an opportunity because I wasn't meeting anybody in this business. So I wanted to be a mom. So it's basically like all these things were happening at one time and I had all this freelance stuff. Like, you know, eventually it's just an easy decision.
What I'm having trouble wrapping my head around is your company one of a kind? I mean, when I mention Conair or L'Oreal, they have ad agencies.
That's right.
Who take care of all those things for them, you know, write the copy, promote them. What made you different?
We can look at L'Oreal, for example.
Okay. Because you have to educate me, and I'm serious. I'm not being facetious.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what niche you're filling.
Yeah, this is a good question. So if we look at L'Oreal, like they're a McCann agency network, right? So their companies and brands are contracted with McCann.
McCann Erickson?
Yeah,
that's
like,
a big
giant global, right?
Mm-hmm. Big agency.
So yes, they are restricted to, in many ways, use those agencies. But there are segments of their business that the agency doesn't service. So for L'Oreal, we did a lot of influencer marketing programs for them. That's just not something that...
What does it mean in English?
So if you are a consumer and you are active on social media or you watch YouTube videos, so mm-hmm. you're a customer who's maybe like a voracious appetite for beauty mm-hmm. And beauty newness and beauty tutorials and things like that, you are often following these women. Some of them are men, but most of the time they're women.
So they're spokespeople for a product?
No, not necessarily. They're more like experts in their space.
All
even
right.
if they're not like full-fledged makeup artists or hairstylists. They have a voice mm-hmm. and they have followers. Therefore, they can influence their followers to be inspired by a brand or a product. So influencer marketing is basically, you know, trying to find the right audience of influencers who have the right audience of, you know, fans and customers to promote a product in an indirect way. So it's not a spokesperson where I'm handing over cash and I'm telling you what to say and then you're getting in the camera and saying it. That happens too. But the types of programming that we work with is much more, it feels more organic to the customer, to the fan.
So it's somebody touting the virtues, I'm not being facetious, mm-hmm. of L'Oreal mascara.
Yes, because they feel like they love it in that moment. Yes.
And that's more potent than my watching a television commercial about L'Oreal mascara or seeing an ad in a magazine.
I don't feel like it's more potent. I think that there's a mix that has to happen. Smaller brands, like mm-hmm. let's leave the L'Oreal world and just think about like a founder-owned brand under $5 million of sales, mm-hmm. They're not doing advertising, right? They're not paying
because they can't afford it.
Right. They're not paying for TV. They're not paying for print. They're probably doing some digital stuff on uh-huh. social, but that's it. And it's not very targeted and sophisticated. But they don't have any other choice than to work the influencer marketing programs, right? Where else? Who else can they talk to, right? They can't afford those other tools.
And so you come in and what do you do for them?
We help them develop a story around the product launch. Sometimes a brand launch, but most often a product launch mm-hmm. in this space. And then how is it going to be received by the influencer and make them so excited about it that they have no, like nothing is going to hold them back from talking about it and why they're so excited about it and how they're going to use it and how they're going to inspire their fans. So that's so what the influencer marketing does on a very tactical level.
Right. And as an influencer is not necessarily a bold-faced name.
It does not have to be. Mm-hmm. It can be.
Can I be an influencer?
Yes. I'm sure you were an influencer in your space.
Right. Okay.
Right.
And also I'm targeting a specific audience because
right.
I'm older.
What's better than targeting? Nothing. Larger brands have no choice but to have a great marketing mix in a lot of ways they spend their money. Small brands, they don't have a lot of options. So they really work the influencer space. But, for the larger brands, they can really spend the money to do really elaborate programs. So that's how we help them. So our business is split 50% of the businesses with these strategics, right? So we do work with L'Oreal and Shiseido and Coty and L'Oreal brands. And then the other half of the work is with independent brands. So they're not really like mom and pop making products at their kitchen sink. They can't afford to work with an agency, but they're brands who have proven themselves in the marketplace and they have a marketing budget and they have needs for growth.
So you have a team?
Yes, there's 10 of us. Yes.
That you hired everybody?
Yes, this is my team.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you don't have to answer this specifically. You're making money?
We don't make a ton of money. Mm-hmm. I don't make a ton of money right now. And this is really the internal struggle I have and have had for many years. So I've been doing this for 10 years. And I've always been very confident that I have unlimited earning potential.
Unlimited learning potential. Okay.
I really mm-hmm. feel like it is unlimited.
The sky's the limit.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I laugh to myself, like kind of a funny laugh, but kind of a sad laugh, that like, when am I going to see that potential realized? Mm-hmm. Right? So there are some years that are really shitty mm-hmm. Where I really make no money.
But you're able to pay your employees.
Yeah, I pay my team. There's times where I have to lay people off. Mm-hmm. There's times where the workload is such that they're only independent contractors. They're not full-time employees. There's some, we basically like follow Department of Labor laws to a T. And like when there's a lot of work, we have people doing it. When there's not a lot of work, we have a bunch of independent contractors
doing it. So
that
has to be stressful, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's gotten like that. Part has gotten less stressful because I found sort of this pocket of really talented, smart people who many of them want to be independent contractors and want to say no to work, right? Because they are kind of at the stage of life where I am.
And they're
going to
stick by you in a loyal sense.
Yeah. And many of them have left full-time jobs because they don't want a full-time job anymore. So they are dedicated to their work, but they want to be able to say, no, I don't want to travel for that client. I want to stay home with my kids, right? So I'm able to find these really talented people who have the flexibility in their life and their work needs to be able to roll with, the ups and downs of the business.
Do you work out of an office?
Well, we have an office, a WeWork office on 34th Street. That's our hub, but we operate as a virtual business and have for 10 years. So my team, for the most part, works from wherever they want to work. Mm-hmm. And we come to the office when we need to.
Are you part of a marketing strategy? I mean, are you just kind of always on the prowl?
So that's my job at the agency now. And I made the commitment a year ago to myself that I'm going to get myself out of the minutiae of the work mm-hmm. and really focus on, telling the story of the agency and building the agency and amplifying, what we do. Because we are distinctive. You ask the question, like, why is Base Beauty existing? What need is it filling?
Right.
We're a very small agency that's incredible. Nimble with like top talent, but we do not have the fees of a McCann Erickson, of course, much lower overhead. But we have the brain power and we're also total beauty experts. And you really can't find that many places. We're beauty experts in an omni-channel world. So we can work on every single thing the customer sees and touches.
So it can go from foundation again to mascara to body cream.
Yes, anything in the beauty and wellness space. But really what I'm talking about when I say omni is every touch point for the customer. So whether she's at retail experiencing the product packaging and the visual merchandising tools and the promotions and the storytelling at retail, or she's, communicating with a brand on social, through social content and tutorial videos, incredible photography, or maybe it's digital marketing or PR. Like, our agency is servicing every single basically marketing need of a client, so that our client, number one, is giving like one integrated story to her customer. The customer is having one experience with the brand, no matter where she's discovering the brand and where she's interacting with the brand. But it also offers our clients incredible optimization for finances. Like, it's one agency, it's one phone call to do all this type of work. Typically, you'd have a packaging agency over here, and then you have a social agency over here, and then you might have another team doing production for filming, for videos, and you'd have another digital marketing agency creating work for you here, and we're one team advocating for our clients.
But your client list doesn't necessarily include very well-established brands, because the marketing has already been determined by a different agency, like a McCann Erickson.
Yeah, so for L'Oreal, we're not doing everything Omni for them, right? They have other partners, but mm-hmm. we're doing part of their puzzle,
okay,
right?
Okay, I get what you're
and
saying.
And then for other clients, we really do. We're like, they basically say, here are our launches for the next year. What are you going to do? They identify a budget and their key goals, and we work through that and on a monthly basis, creating the content that needs to get pushed
out.
What
did you do for Weight Watchers, for example?
Weight Watchers are commercial campaigns for digital. So they have a license for scales, right? Branded scales. So we created commercials for them that ran on their app, and it ran on social, and it ran on, YouTube or wherever, to help promote the scales business for Weight Watchers.
So where do you think you are right now with your company? And is there anything you want to change? Is there anything that you want to do differently? Are you feeling really optimistic, enthusiastic?
The past year has been really transformative for me. I hired a coach in last November. So I've been working with a business coach for a year because I was feeling really lonely in the process of running the business. And like, I was alone in my own head for 9 years.
Well, as the person running the business, I can see how you would feel that way. So, no,
right.
I'm being very serious.
It's really exhausting.
Who is it that you can talk to?
Right. I have friends who run similar size businesses, and that's been incredibly helpful. But I had a lot of ideas in my head, and I really just didn't know which one to move forward with. Like, I was feeling very stuck. So I have a friend who runs a PR agency, and she seemed really serene. When in a way that I really had never been. And I asked her how she does it, and she said that she's learned how to deal with the stress, right? It's really like a roller coaster. I am always on the roller coaster. I can't get off. Like, honestly, like, how could I give up the freedom and flexibility I get in running my business to go work somewhere, right? I'd get more money for sure, but I'd also have to be in their office. I'd have to, deal with their hierarchy.
Well, it's sort of like saying to you, give up your son, because this is a child to you and you just can't do that.
It's a lifestyle that I really, really appreciate, despite mm-hmm. the fact that I'm not rolling in the dough. Right?
Okay, but that doesn't matter.
So anyway, so she was like super serene, and she said that she understands the ups and downs, just handles them differently, but she also has a great coach. So I said, okay, sign me up. So I started working with Alan a year ago, and it's really changed like my headspace. It's opened me up to a world of tools and other people that I can also hire to help me through things. And after Alan, I started working with a coach for like how to close business. So I think I'm a pretty good door opener. I know a lot of people and have a lot of fun just talking about our business. Like, if I could just be paid to just talk all mm-hmm. the time, I just mm-hmm. would. But I didn't know how to close a deal. I really didn't. I was like such an infant. So I hired Maggie to help me figure out like, how do I like get you from the point where we're having a conversation and we're talking about a budget and a schedule to say like, okay, let's do it.
Right.
Or let's not do it. Just give me an answer, right? So this has been such a transformative year. I started the podcast in January, and that's been incredible. I started the podcast series as a way to humanize the business for me, right? To like want to know more about the people on stage and the people behind the scenes, most certainly, and how they deal with stuff. Like, I was having a really hard time dealing with this, like very stressed out. Like, every morning I wake up and my heart is racing, right? And I don't know why. And I think it's just like this like muscle memory of like for years it was really, really, really hard. It's a little less hard now, but it for years is really, really hard. And my heart just has a memory of every day waking up thinking this is going to be really stressful and hard today. So I wanted to know more about the people in my business, and I want to have a humanizing experience for me. This is like therapy for me. And what I found is that it's been very therapeutic for others. And our listeners who are entrepreneurs are listening to it because they really need to get inside the experience.
And they're getting good advice.
Yes, like really incredible things that people really don't say out loud. Mm-hmm. Like, they hardly ever say this stuff in public.
And the name of your podcast again?
It's Where Brains Meet Beauty. Mm-hmm. And the other way that people use the podcast, which I think is so cool, is like a souped up LinkedIn. So on LinkedIn, you can see someone's resume, right? But you don't get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
So the series has become a way to get to know somebody before you get to know them in real life. And I think that's so cool, right? Like if we're going to go have a meeting with somebody and you want to get to know them, well, yeah, you're going to look at
LinkedIn.
You have
a sense of who they are. Right?
But now you can listen to a 30-minute episode, which is so incredible.
Well, that is a great segue for me to say, I got to get to know you through this podcast.
That's right.
Yeah.
We're recording in the studio where I record
exactly.
as well.
Exactly. So there it's a little incestuous. So here you go, from the woman who was moving papers from one pile to another to now owning your own company and being successful. And yes, it has its ups and downs, but I bet that you feel really good about you.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot of therapy, honestly, and a lot of people to talk to get to the place where I realize that, like, every day has its ups and downs, and that's just part of life.
Of course, that's right.
There is no perfection, and mm-hmm. I've been really working over the past 10 years to unravel a perfectionist tendency in me. And to realize that, like, this is really cool. Like, I'm at the point in my business where, like, big brands are finding us. Like, it's not like I'm hunting them down, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're finding us. Do we get all the work? No, right? But we get to put proposals out there. We get our name out there. We're getting to the point where people are coming to us for interviews, for expert opinions on topics. Like, this is really exciting. So what I need to do in this time, and I'm realizing it, that I need to talk about it more, is how to be at ease with the fact that I don't know when that unlimited earning potential will be realized, right? I feel very impatient about it. I've been working hard for 10 years. I'm exhausted for 10 years. When is that payday happening? And I'm not in the acceptance phase yet of just being able to realize that I don't know when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is part of the journey.
The whole point of this is it's always a journey. You never really reach your destination.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, well, I want to thank you for joining me today. So I wish you continued success.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me into
your
podcast.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure, Jody. Really nice. And good luck.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.